Welcome to another monthly edition of the Student Press Law Center podcast. I'm Frank Lomani, the executive director of the Student Press Law Center, and every month we get together to talk about developments affecting the legal rights of student journalists at the high school and college level and the educators who work with them. Sometimes we bring on a guest to share with us an interesting piece of journalistic work that we think is of importance to the field. And this month we're with Lauren Schroeder, who's with the Medill Justice Project at Northwestern University in Illinois. We're going to listen to her in a moment talk about her research on the instance of shaken baby syndrome diagnoses across America. And just by way of introduction, Lauren has been working with the Medill Justice Project since she was a graduate student at Northwestern University in their master's program. She has her undergraduate degree from Michigan State. She received her master's from the Medill Journalism School in August of 2013, and since that time has been working for the director, Alec Klein, as a research fellow. She got her start with the Justice Project investigating one of their signature cases, a murder case that was brought to the attention of the project as a potentially wrongful conviction, which is the work for which the Medill Justice Project is, I guess, most famously known. So, Lauren, I really appreciate you joining us on the podcast. And let's get started. I guess first, if you don't mind, give folks the website address where they can look up this research that you've gathered on shaken baby syndrome, and then we want to hear about how you put the project together.
Sure. The public can access the Medill Justice website at medilljusticeproject.org. And the project was originally started in 1999 through Northwestern University, investigating potentially wrongfully convicted inmates. Professor Alec Klein got a tip about a shaken baby syndrome case, and at the time, taking on this type of case was usually just not done. Mostly just because they're difficult. There wasn't a lot of research in the subject. There's usually no adult witnesses. So Alec originally took on the case mostly because he heard from others that it was difficult, and he spoke with other experts in the field about creating a database. And experts, again, said, it's too difficult, don't do it. And so, of course, Alec did it.
Right.
What we first found in the beginning was that it was incredibly difficult to find these cases. Typically, they're not tagged in the legal system as a shaken baby syndrome case. They're tagged as child abuse cases or endangering the welfare of a child. So we reached out to experts who had done their own individual collection of cases, and we added those to our database, as well as collecting cases through press accounts. Usually in the press, they would say a doctor had diagnosed the child with shaken baby syndrome, and we would use that to search through public database records in specific states around the country. We began collecting this information last summer. It took about a year to confirm these cases that they were indeed shaken baby syndrome cases, and then we started analyzing them this past summer.
So you're working off of, it looks like, a universe of about 3,000 cases that you're able to identify around the country, and that's going back about a period of 25 years, correct?
Correct. Our earliest cases date back to around 1988, and then we have cases that occurred as early as this year.
Okay. And so this universe consists of cases where you were able to find information out there on the public record in somewhere, either some combination of a news account, a court record, or some combination of those where someone had been accused of a crime where the diagnosis of the child's death was shaken baby syndrome, correct?
Correct. When we first gathered the cases, it was usually attached with the name of the person accused. And once we did confirm that it was a shaken baby syndrome case, we then verified the location of the case by running the defendant's name or other significant identifiers, such as the judge that presided over the case and any officials that were in the court system. And so we use that to verify the location of the case and where it occurred.
And so from there, obviously, because these are criminal cases, they leave a pretty substantial paper trail. So you're able to, using courthouse records, I guess, look at what it is the person was charged with, how the crime was disposed of, right? That lead through the news media and leads you to the file at the courthouse.
Correct. Either the file at the courthouse or the Department of Corrections if the person was convicted and sentenced for a certain amount of time. Usually with any case involving a child, it has a real visceral power with the public, and so it's going to be covered by the media, and that's where we got most of our cases.
Right, right. Well, so people who visit the MedillJusticeProject.org website are going to see a map that you created that shows what are identified as hotspots, basically places around the country that tend to be particularly prone to the diagnosis of shaken baby syndrome. So I guess the question is now, having looked at a very large sampling of these cases, 3,000 cases covering a period of 25 years, and observing that these cases tend to cluster around the country, what, if anything, can we conclude from that?
Well, there's a whole slew of information that I guess you could get from this, from our database. We did realize that in terms of the number of cases, the locations mirrored population size, which with anything like that, you're going to get a population effect. Where there's more people, there's going to be a higher probability that these cases are going to occur. So what we did is we then took our information and found a rate per population, basically saying how many cases per 100,000 people have happened in this area and whether or not it's expected or unexpected based on the population size. And so from that information, we found that there were certain areas, Sarpy County, Nebraska, Richmond, Georgia, Weber, Utah, Douglas, Nebraska, and Summit, Ohio had the highest rate.
So having now worked on this research, for a number of months, is it possible to conclude that that the reason that certain localities have a larger incidence of this diagnosis than others is attributable to the practices of the local coroner or the local medical examiner, or is it perhaps connected to the fact that there had been one highly publicized case in the area and that therefore causes people to report otherwise? I guess what I'm wondering is, are you able to deduce any kind of cause and effect from these statistics?
We were able to determine several factors that could lead a certain area to have a higher rate than others. Obviously, we can't say that these are the known factors and these are the only known factors, but we can make deductions, we can make guesses as to why this is occurring in certain areas. It could be a really aggressive prosecutor in the area that takes child abuse cases very seriously. It could be the influence of a large hospital system, or it could be the influence of one doctor within a hospital system that's overseeing all the child abuse cases. It could be a geography quirk where they're, like, for example, in Weber, Utah, that is where the National Center on Shaken Baby Syndrome was founded. And so from that, we were able to guess that when there's an organization like that that heavily influences the media, that heavily influences the public's awareness of an issue, it could lead to a higher rate in that area. And also, of course, the press would be a factor in high-profile cases. If a high-profile case occurred somewhere, then the press is going to be more likely to cover up a following case. And it could also influence how the prosecution handles that type of case after a high-profile case.
That's interesting. So by reminder, my guest is Lauren Schroeder. She's with the Medill Justice Project at Northwestern University, and we're talking about her research, which you can find online at MedillJusticeProject.org, about the instance of shaken baby cases across the United States over the last 25 years. And Lauren, I mean, I guess this is really for somebody who is a college journalist, or even a professional journalist who's interested in the subject and maybe on a smaller scale is interested in retracing your steps or trying to replicate a research project of this kind. What were maybe some of your takeaways or tips about having, you know, plowed through this research? What sorts of difficulties or obstacles did you encounter in trying to piece these records together? And if I had known then what I know now, tips for somebody who's trying to do this type of research themselves?
Well, it was a lot of reporting. It was a lot of emailing, a lot of calling. I basically was calling district attorney's offices across the country, delivering bad news, saying you are at the top of our list in terms of high rate of shaken baby syndrome. And also, it was hard to pin down what exactly is going on in one area. I don't think anyone can do that. It's really just figuring out the facts that could play a part in this. It's part instinct and part following the facts. You don't want to make assumptions about what's going on in a certain area. You want to figure out these are the facts that could be influencing a certain area.
Is it possible to conclude, and having done this research now, do you have any conclusions or impressions as to whether shaken baby syndrome is sort of systemically an overused diagnosis? Is it something that we can say with any degree of confidence that it's being overused, overdiagnosed, and that it's possible that people are being wrongly accused of crimes when perhaps the baby died of some cause that's not related to violence at all?
I think that there are issues. There is an issue with someone being wrongfully convicted of this, mostly just because of the science behind it. That's why shaken baby syndrome has become such an issue. Shaken baby syndrome is marked by a triad of symptoms. It's usually marked by brain bleeding, brain swelling, and bleeding within the eyes. And so in the past, prosecutors or a medical examiner would see that triad, and they would usually convict the person that had last watched over the child because the symptoms were believed to be onset and almost immediate. But recent studies now have shown that the child can have a period of lucidness, and the symptoms may not show immediately. And they also have discovered that these symptoms may also be the cause of other underlying medical issues. There's issues with blood clotting that can cause this kind of effect. So I think the issue is that there are indeed people that are abusing the child in some cases. But in other cases where there isn't corroborating evidence, like bruises, cuts, burns, broken legs, other underlying causes need to be considered before accusing someone of abusing a child.
Now, having built this database, having gathered this research, what are you hoping is going to happen next? What are you hoping that journalists or researchers or policymakers are going to do with this body of work that you've gathered?
I hope that it is a public service to everyone. On a national level, it can show where things need to be done. On a local level, I hope that local journalists will take this information on our website and say, we have this many cases in our area. We have this rate per population. What's going on in our area that's making it this way? As someone that's doing a national study, having to look at all of these different locations in my article, I wasn't really able to firmly determine what's going on there because most of these places were places that you don't necessarily know where they are. And so for a local journalist, you could probably say, well, I have contacts in all of these hospitals and all of these prosecuting offices and get down to the bottom level about what's going on. So hopefully they can take that information, recognize that there's a problem, and do something about it, make an improvement, educate parents before they leave the hospital, educate teens that are going to be babysitters and eventually having children of their own, and hopefully that we can put a stop to this problem before it happens, not after the fact when we're convicting someone of child abuse.
Yeah, it sounds like your research has really identified, a couple of phenomena that might be remarkable. I mean, one is frankly the fact that there are a disturbing number of children who are dying while they're in the care of either parents or caretakers in what appear to be violent deaths. That's a distressing and horrible thing. And then the fact that there may be a lack of uniformity in the diagnostic system, which may be both, I suppose, under and over reporting this. There is a story up on your website accompanying the map at the Medill Justice Project, in which one of the potential shortcomings that you pinpoint to, right, is the qualifications and training of the people who are in the business of doing these death certificates and assigning a cause of death, right? I mean, that's one area, I guess, where public policymakers might take a look at this research and give it a second thought.
Correct. In Sarpy and Douglas County, Nebraska, that's one of the factors that I thought, or that we thought might be playing a role, is that the county attorney in each county of Nebraska is also the county coroner, and they're the ones that are going to decide what was the cause of death, and they're also the ones that are going to decide whether or not an investigation needs to be done. And just looking into Nebraska, I found a slew of research that's been done about the coroner and medical examiner systems in the United States and how different they are, and how there needs to be a uniform practice, how there needs to be qualified training in these positions when they're making heavy-duty decisions on in both medical and criminal justice fields.
Well, so I know your fellowship goes through the spring semester of the coming academic year. So what's next for you on this project, Lauren? Are you finished with this, or where does it go next?
We're actually working to create a similar database in South Africa. There's a class at the Medill School of Journalism that's going to be studying South Africa this coming quarter, learning about the court system and also analyzing shaken baby syndrome cases. And then the following quarter, they're going to be in South Africa. And we're hoping to create a database, not quite to this magnitude of what we have in the United States, but a large database about including shaken baby syndrome cases that they can analyze in South Africa. And from my research that I've been able to do right now following my article is that there is a definite need there. We just haven't been able to figure out what's the best way of collecting these cases. Another thing that I would want to examine in our database is the age of the defendant. Part of our verification process was I had to read through every single verification document for every single case, all 3,043 mm-hmm. of them. And one thing that I noticed just by going through these on a daily basis is that most of our accused are teenagers. They're teenagers or young adults that are having children or are the babysitters. And so hopefully the next project that I would be able to work on with this database is analyzing the numbers on the age of the accused.
It's a fascinating project and a fascinating use of journalistic research skills to build a knowledge base like this. In the minute or two that we have left, anything by way of wrap-up, either on this project or more generally on the work of the Medill Justice Project that you want to share?
These crimes are happening in the United States, and what I hope comes from my research is further research. That's the only way that you can get more answers. That's the only way that you can determine how to fix it. And so I'm hoping that people will look at the database, will read the story, and realize that there is a need to further analyze these cases, to take each case differently. They're not uniform. They all have different factors. And to look at each case independently so that we're not making wrong decisions.
Well, Lauren Scher, I want to thank you for joining us on the SPLC podcast. I want to encourage everybody to visit the www.medilljusticeproject.org website, and hopefully journalists around the country will take a look at this research, will build on it, will poke holes in it, will do their own research inspired by it. We hope that those listening will check out all the resources on the Student Press Law Center website as well. That's www.splc.org. If you're interested in doing journalism involving research into public records, we can help. Use our attorney hotline, 703-807-1904, or email splc@splc.org if you've got any questions about your right to public records or anything concerning your legal rights as a journalist. Thanks to Lauren Schroeder from the Medill Justice Project at Northwestern University, and thank you for listening. We'll see you next month.